Willkommen zum Faster You Podcast, wo sich alles um Ausdauersport und Training dreht. Hier geben euch Sebastian Schlurike, Björn Kafka und Niklas Hanker wertvolle Tipps und Einblicke, die euch helfen, eure Performance auf das nächste Level zu bringen. Hello to a new episode of the Faster You Podcast. Today with Björn and again Michael Lieberson and also Andrew Buckrell, both from the Endurance Innovation Podcast. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hey, Niklas. Hey, Björn.
Hi. So, maybe there are some listeners around who do not know Michael. I'm sorry. And maybe you have to introduce yourself again. And Andrew, for sure, you have to do that. Maybe we start this time with Andrew. Yeah.
Sure, I can do a quick introduction. So my background is mechanical engineering. I've got a PhD in heat transfer and fluid dynamics, and it's really where my passion lies, just figuring out whether it's aerodynamics, kind of fluid flow, heat transfer for performance-related reasons, things like that is what I'm really passionate about. My introduction to the cycling industry was back in about 2016. I started a company called Stack Performance, and we made bike trainers that some people may be familiar with. We were purchased by Four Eyes in 2019, and throughout that time, I had also developed a technology, the virtual wind tunnel, which allowed 3D scanning and aerodynamic analysis of athletes. So definitely a lot of fun to be involved in this industry, and I love talking about these things and really nerding out and geeking out about them.
Thank you. Michael.
Oh, well, thanks, Bjorn. Thanks, Niklas, for having us on. Andrew is the guy that I go to when I have aerodynamic questions. So I'm like, hey, is this faster? What do you think about this? Can we do this with that technology?
It depends
is the answer I usually get. We were joking about that earlier, but that's actually the case. So my name is Michael, and I am also a mechanical engineer, although I quit after getting my undergrad. I was not as committed as Andrew was. To my education, I guess. In the sports world, I still coach very kind of on the small scale these days, but I used to be a full-time triathlon coach. I ran a triathlon studio, which is where Andrew and I first met. I co-host the Endurance Innovation Podcast, Bjorn, as you mentioned, and a podcast on which you've been a guest, I think, three or four times.
Multiple. Is that a record?
No.
I think maybe Bjorn is in the lead. It's either, okay. It's
no,
either
really?
Or Tilbury Davis. Anyway.
I thought Michael Lieber, Michael Erickson is also.
He's also in the running. That's also true. Yes, he's a favorite of ours as well. And then other than the podcast, Andrew and I have recently launched a kind of an interesting product, which maybe we'll talk a little bit about. It has a lot to do with cooling. I don't want to talk too much about it, but it's we think it's the only on-bike, so per-cooling solution that is available. So kind of relevant to the topic of discussion today.
Yes, and today we talk about heat and cooling. The idea came because you ran a very nice series about heat and cooling on your podcast. I think 4 or 5 episodes, really, really deep dive into what to do with heat and how to get rid of it. And we can't do that, or we can do 8 hours. Let's talk about that a little bit. And maybe we start... easier, yeah. So usually we have like a normal temperature of, I don't know, 37 degrees, yeah. So it's more or less a small range where we can perform. And what is happening when our body is getting a little bit warmer, yeah? And how we start to cool ourselves, maybe that's the first thing. What are we doing? How is our body reacting when we start cooling? Yeah, I mean like from inside, not from external. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, what are the mechanisms we have?
Andrew, go for it. we're gonna want to talk over each other here, so I'm sorry for the editor of this podcast.
Yeah, so there's the way that your body cools itself normally is just by increasing the skin temperature slightly. So your metabolism upregulates or downregulates a little bit, but it will increase your skin temperature, which increases the temperature difference from your body to the environment and drives more heat transfer. So as you start to exercise, your skin temperature will go up. And then once you reach a certain point, your body will start to sweat. And sweat is incredibly efficient in dry climates at removing heat. It's not very efficient in wet climates, but your body doesn't really have built-in humidity sensors. So it's, you know, distinguishing between those two. Like, you're still going to sweat if you're in Kona versus if you're in Arizona. The sweat removal, or the sweat acts as heat removal because the phase change from liquid to vapor carries so much energy with it. So you get this massive cooling bump by just evaporating sweat versus just having that normal dry skin that's driving the heat transfer.
Mm-hmm. Is there something like percentage-wise, what roughly how much heat transfer we get from evaporation from the other one?
I don't have an exact number that I can go to. I wish I did, but I would say there's probably a multiple, maybe five times as much heat that evaporation can carry away. Now, that I could be wrong on that. So if someone listening has a better idea and has access to thermodynamic tables that I don't have in front of me right now, then I apologize.
Where's your stoichiometry textbook? Come on, Andrew.
It's behind me. It's on the shelf behind me. I think it's collecting dust right now. So.
I think I have something like 70-80% in mind, something like that. Pretty high, also depending on the humidity, of course, if it works or not. So it's super efficient, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and evaporation is really it's one of the reasons that that humans can exercise for a long period of time. So it allows us to do endurance sports where other animals, so dogs panting, for example, dogs I think only sweat on their paws, and they pant normally to get the heat out. So they can't really exercise for quite as long in warm climates. So that's a good example of how humans are better adapted to endurance exercise and just how much heat we remove through evaporation and sweating.
Mm-hmm. So now we know that a little bit. What actually happens when it's getting too hot? Yeah, how does it affect the body in terms of performance?
Well, on this one, there are some pretty good studies. So initially, when we do, for example, a warm up before serious exercise begins, there is actually value in increasing the temperature of the muscles a little bit above baseline. And I'm sure anyone listening is probably experienced this before. When you first start out, things feel a little bit crunky. You know, maybe RPE is a little bit higher than you would expect. Things aren't moving as well. And of course, there's lots of things that happen. There's all sorts of like oxygen kinetic things that happen. But there's pretty good evidence that a slight increase in muscle temperature actually is performance. Right. So your muscles do perform a little bit better when they are above baseline. But there's of course a limiting factor. So it's individual a little bit, and it can be trained a little bit, we believe, but generally above 38.5 degrees centigrade. And now we're talking about core temperature. Generally the most people will see a decline in performance. Go ahead, Andrew.
There is a study that I love referencing. Michael, you probably know what's coming here, but yes. There was a cycling, a UCI World Championship event that it was time trial and team time trial that was instrumented. It was in Doha, Qatar.
Sorry to interrupt. I worked with the under-23 athlete who won the under-23 World Championships in Doha. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Now you can go on. I hope I'm right. Yes, I think this was Marco Mattis in that year. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so I think this was back in 2016. I don't remember the athletes involved, but they had instrumented quite a number of different athletes. And what they found was that trained athletes were able to push the ceiling quite a bit higher than anyone had ever expected in terms of core body temperature. There was still a limitation, but at the end of the event, they were pushing 41 degrees Celsius, which in in previous expertise would have been the point for hyperthermia. Basically, they would have assumed that these people would be on the verge of death at those temperatures, but they were still performing at quite a high output. I think it was reduced capacity, as you would understand, but still to be productive at those kind of temperatures was a new finding.
Mm-hmm. One technical question. I know the study, but I'm not in the technical details anymore. How did they measure it? Did they really have something? Did they swallow a pill or did they put it behind?
And fortunately, they swallowed the pill.
Okay.
So. Yeah, rectal thermometers on a bicycle would be uncomfortable.
Yes.
Yeah, the preferred method of measurement. They followed that.
Yeah. Yes.
So okay. It wasn't, for example, with the core body temperature sensor. That didn't exist at the time of this study.
Yes.
But it was a direct measurement. It was the pill, which is, I think, one of the gold standards in terms of core body temperature.
Yeah.
I also think back in the days, Tony Martin already did heat training on his rollers in front of a radiator to become a TT world champion, right?
I'm not sure, but I know Bradley Wiggins, for example, in his book he wrote after his Tour de France and Olympic gold, when he did the Vuelta in 2011, he already trained in a sauna. This heat adaptation thing was well known. It was before Blumenfeld won in Tokyo. A lot of people did kind of a heat adaptation. I think now it's more clear how it works. And this is maybe the next point, which I think is quite interesting. You can train that. And highly trained athletes are more capable of getting hotter. It seems like that. So usually, Michael, how long does it take to adapt to heat?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's so much interest, as you say, Bjorn, in this pursuit now for heat adaptations. We just Andrew and I just came back from Ironman Texas, which was the North American Championship, and it was the day ended around 29, 30 degrees, and it was reasonably humid. And there were lots of folks like us who were coming from, northern climates and did not do so well in that race. So I know we actually interviewed one of them who did a fairly robust protocol for adaptation. But it does depend. If you are just looking to adapt to the heat, and we're not looking for heat training for the other sort of performance enhancing effects. Mm-hmm. I think generally the protocol is around 2 weeks is what I've heard cited. So kind of in that ballpark of 10 to 14 days, where you get a lot of the what I would consider acute benefits of adaptation training. So there's physiological stuff which we can definitely talk about, but I also want to make sure that we talk about the psychological aspects of it, because a lot of it is tolerance and the tolerance, the psychological sort of tolerance, because being hot is uncomfortable and it's a sort of, it's a noise in our head when we get warm, and that often is a pretty significant limiter to further performance, to either going faster or maintaining a level of performance. So I think both physiological and psychological elements are worth talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. For example, the recent guest that we had was Miranda Tomlinson on our show, who was the one of the athletes that we were supporting in Texas. She did a pretty robust heat prep phase, and one of the things that she spoke to, which was interesting to me, was that one of the things that she found valuable from the heat prep phase was that she learned what it felt like to be hot. So what the feeling was, and then she learned that she was, that feeling was okay, that it wasn't a red alert that things are going off the rails, that she proved to herself, and I hope I'm not putting words in her mouth, that she was able to tolerate that level of, let's say, thermal discomfort, and that was found quite valuable in the race itself as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think there's also some, if you take some something in your mouth, something like peppermint, experiment, stuff like that only gives you the sensation of being cooler already helps. Yeah, it will not down regulate your temperature, core body temperature, but you feel cooler. Yeah, and this also helps. Yeah.
Yeah.
So actually, if you know, what is the difference between like this heat training that everyone is doing, to get a higher plasma volume, for example, and a normal heat adaptation?
What do you mean by normal heat adaptation? Like just being out in like the heat?
I mean, like now, if you, for example, you go to the Cape Epic, the mountain bike race, and I mean, like, 10 years ago, where nobody was talking about heat training to get a higher plasma volume, or maybe 15 years ago, we did normal heat training to get adapted to the heat in South Africa, for example. Is there any difference? Are the protocols different? Do you know that? Or is it more like, 10 years ago, people were going into the sauna or even riding in the sauna, Today, we put on a lot of clothes and riding at a certain power and looking at the sensor and telling us what's going on, Is there any difference?
Hang on.
Okay. No, it's all good.
So this is where I would say that I am not the best expert to Bjorn. But what I will do is I will hypothesize. I think the literature that I've read is that the important parameter is elevating core body temperature and keeping it elevated for a certain period of time. And that provides a stimulus. So if you're looking at just directly, the blood plasma volume sort of effect, how you get there seems to be less important than the fact that you get there and you stay there for a certain amount of time. I think in line with what I was saying earlier about the psychological elements, there is value in doing it in your chosen modality, whether you're running, riding a bike, whatever the case may be. So definitely, especially closer to the main event, it does make sense, rather than just sitting in a sauna and getting your core temperature up that way, is that you're actually learning what it feels like to be pushing the watts that you want to be pushing, for example, when you are in that elevated heat condition. So I think if we're going from general training principles, you go from general to specific. I would say if you're looking for the early season blood plasma gains, it probably doesn't matter too much. But the closer that you get to your goal event, the more specific you want that stimulus to be. And in which case you would combine those two stimuli of the thermal stimulus plus the actual, chosen training, chosen sport stimulus. That's how I would look at it.
Yeah. How close can we actually get from like normal performance level to heat adapted when we go to a warmer place? Do you know? Is it like 95%?
This is really interesting. This is what Andrew and I talked about this a little bit. So are you talking about comparing top performance in cool conditions versus warm conditions?
Yes.
So I think that's that gap is narrowing dramatically. So again, I'm going to keep talking about Texas because we just came back from there. So it's very top of mind. But the performances in Texas were like outstanding. There were numerous course records broken. So Ironman Texas, for imagine most of your listeners will know, the North American Championship, full distance Ironman. The Christian Blumenfeld broke the course record. He ran a 2:34 marathon off of a world record breaking bike. I think Cam Wurf went a little bit faster on the bike than Christian, but they both broke the previous course record. And it was warm. It was close to 30 degrees and humid. So, and then on the women's side, Kat Matthews also, she also broke the record. So. And she ran, I think she ran a 2:50 or something like that, or maybe a 2:49. So an incredibly fast Ironman marathon as well. And these folks are, Blumenfeld is of course from Norway and Kat Matthews is from the UK. So they're not Australians or Brazilians. They're from Northern climes. So I would say that I think we're getting really close. I think probably within like 98% at the very pointy end, the folks who are the most adapted are probably very, very close to almost as fast in cool conditions.
If we are talking about the perfect body, to get used to heat or perform well in heat, I mean, like Christian Blumenfeld is maybe not the best example.
No, neither is Cap Matthews. They're built. Yes. They're not built like, if you think about, you know, the folks who we consider historically to be the best in the heat would be Kenyan marathoners, right? Or like East African marathoners who, you know, the way that I always pictured it, they're like human radiators, right? So they're fairly tall, very thin limbs, right? So their surface area to volume ratio is very high, which is what you want, because you want maximal sort of, you know, opportunity for heat exchange with the environment. But yeah, Christian and Kat are not like Kenyan marathoners, and they're still performing exceptionally well.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure, maybe Andrew, this is something for you. Our body also can store heat, and there's kind of a heat capacity in muscles and also in fat, and I mean, like, the less fat you have, the better it is. Is that more or less right? Is there, or can we pin a number on that? How much more heat can we store in muscles compared to fat? Or is it too technical to ask that?
It's an excellent question. I don't know that I have an answer off the top of my head. I do know that the vast majority of our body composition is water. And water is one of those fluids, or it is the fluid in nature that has one of the highest specific heat capacities. And that measure is basically how much energy it takes to raise the temperature by a degree. So that specific heat capacity for water is exceptionally high, not as high as phase change, but it makes our bodies really well adapted at storing heat, which is why a lot of animals, like you can go through sprints without overheating, because you're just storing that. And I always look at it with kind of a bucket analogy. So your bucket would be, you know, the total amount of heat that your body can tolerate, and you start with maybe a half full bucket for normal temperature. The amount you're adding water to that bucket would be how much heat you're generating by exercise, and how quickly you're draining it is how much cooling you're getting. So if your generation outweighs your removal, eventually you'll get to the point where your bucket overflows, which is where your body shuts down. Hopefully you don't get quite to that point, but the increase in the cooling capacity drains that bucket faster. So if you have less clothing on, or if you have evaporation, you're essentially increasing that draining rate. So there's multiple ways to look at this. I don't know that the body composition is necessarily a huge factor, but there could be some internal dynamics with, because muscles need to be supplied with blood and oxygen. There's the same mechanism that is used to exchange the oxygen could be used to exchange heat with the muscles. So you could be using it as an internal cooling system.
Like, muscles would be more water than fat would be, right? So fat would probably, I think fat has a lower specific heat capacity than water. So maybe that has something to do with it. Like if you're leaner, you are more water than if you are less lean.
Good question.
Maybe.
I honestly don't have the answer to it. It's a very interesting question, but if you, like, going back to the idea that you can remove heat from muscles faster just because of the blood flow and the way your body's designed to work, it could be that a leaner body is more efficient at removing heat from the muscles. So I would bet, without any scientific information, but I would bet that that's probably one of the driving factors. And also, the more fat you have, it could be a bit of an insulating layer because the heat is not generated there, so it's further from the surface. Which, you know, it's the reason that whales have blubber. So, using a physiological example or an example from nature, which I think is an excellent instructor, then that would kind of indicate to me that having more fat is beneficial for insulation, and the opposite of what we want in this case.
Yeah. So to maybe pin a number on that or have an idea, if we're talking about gross efficiency, I mean, like, we are like, if we are very lucky, about 23, 24, 25% on the bike. The rest is more or less heat. And then we also have like some solar radiation. How much energy of heat in watts can we actually remove?
you're asking me all the tough questions here.
I'm very sorry. This came, it popped up in my mind. Yeah, and is there, I mean, like, if you have like 400 watts of energy getting on our skin, yeah, or maybe a little bit less, like maybe 200 if we have the surface area, and then we're writing with 300 watts. Then we have probably about 1,000 plus watts of energy that we need to remove. Yeah, and
yeah, it's certainly a lot of energy that we need to remove. So as you said, 23% efficiency, if we use that as a number, if you're generating 230 watts, there would be 1,000 watts of total metabolic energy being used.
Yeah.
And some of that's going out mechanically, which is the power that you're generating, but the rest, the remaining 770 watts would be going out for heat. So some of that would be through sweating and evaporation. Some of that would just be through cooling of the dry areas of your skin. Some of that would be respiration as well. You do lose a bit of heat through your breath exchange. But you're also taking in a pretty substantial amount with solar radiation. So using rough numbers, if it's about 1,100 watts per square meter at noon peak season that you would be generating, and you'd have in the time trial position, let's say half a square meter of area. So you're looking at about 500 watts that would be incident on your body. So the solar loading could be, if you were wearing a nice black absorbent suit, it could be half of what you're generating in terms of the metabolic energy being used. So the solar has a huge impact, but I would say in the neighborhood of 1,000 watts is what our body can dissipate at steady state. There's so many factors, though, like the ambient temperature, you know, all of these things drive heat transfer. But your body, it will do its best to try and remove that. And as your temperature increases, as we were saying before, as your temperature increases, your sweat rate will tend to go up until it hits a saturation point. And there are other mechanisms your body tries to use to adapt and prevent this overheating. But it's a very interesting balance, and it's amazing that all of this can be coordinated without any conscious input.
Mm-hmm. Now we talked more or less about what our body is able to do, but I mean, like, the real thing is like the external thing that we can do. Yeah, I mean, not adaptation, but pouring water on our head, like Floyd Landis when he won the famous tour stage. I don't know how many bottles it was, like 50 or something like that. But we are, of course, many steps further now. What are the cooling strategies used today? And what, in your opinion, both of you, are the best ones? Starting from, like, the cooling vest before the race.
Yeah.
Well, so using the bucket analogy, the cooling vest before the race is essentially draining that bucket a little bit before you ever start filling it. So that offsets the amount of time that you can fill the bucket, that you can add heat to your body without reaching a critical temperature. So that would be a benefit, but you're also trying to balance it with the amount of warm up your muscles have. So like the core central temperature of your body, you want low. Your peripheral temperature for your muscles, you want a little bit higher just for activation. So that would be a fairly effective way of offsetting. But if you're doing a 4 or 5 hour event, then that impact only lasts for maybe an hour. There's a study I was reading recently that they were looking at the effects of pre-cooling, and I think they did a 75-minute low-intensity exercise before doing a time trial, and they found that there was almost no difference after that 75-minute low-intensity exercise. So that was enough to even out your body temperature. But during that phase, it was initially a lower core body temperature, so you would expect better performance there. Mm-hmm. So that would be quite an effective way of doing it. I'm always a big fan of, and this is maybe one of the nerdiest statements I've ever made, but I'm always a big fan of using phase change whenever you can. So if you can turn ice into liquid in your body or through your body heat, that's much better than just letting ice cool down a liquid. So what I mean by that is the phase change, the energy and phase change for going from solid to liquid is something like 5 times the amount of heat that you would have otherwise warming up a cold fluid. So huge amount of heat storage. So if you can ingest an ice slurry during an event, that will be a tremendous way to lower your body temperature. Michael, did you want to add any comments to
that? I was going to talk about ice slushies, ice slurries as well. I think the they are probably the most effective if you want the best bang for your buck. They're probably logistically the most complicated, but if it is feasible, and there are some products on the market that make it more feasible, then ice slushies are the best. And the reason they're the best is because they are the most practical way, I would say, of ingesting ice. And the reason you want to ingest it is because if the ice melts entirely within your body, in your mouth, in your stomach, esophagus, whatever, then all of the energy, you can be confident that all of the energy that's used to melt the ice, to conduct that phase change, is coming from your body, which is exactly what you want. For example, if you were to, obviously not practical on a bicycle, but if you were running and you're holding an ice cube in your hand, as another example, and the temperature from your the warmth from your skin is what's melting that ice cube, that is somewhat less effective because some of the energy to melt that ice cube is coming not from you but from the environment, right? If, for example, a cooling vest, some of the heat gained by that cooling vest is coming from the environment, not all of it is coming from you. So Andrew's point about ice slushies, slurries, that one's real good. So if you can figure out a way to ingest the ice, that's the number one thing that you can do, because
and not get brain freeze.
Yeah, well, yes. Occupational hazard.
There's also a bottle, especially designed for that.
Flow bottle, yeah.
Flow was, bottle,
A gentleman who we had on our podcast before, Paul Larson, who's a Canadian sports scientist working with the New Zealand Triathlon Federation at the time. I want to get that right, but he worked with some folks in New Zealand to create the Flow bottle, which is an insulated sport bottle, round bicycle bottle that is designed specifically to be filled with a slushy solution, and it has a kind of an innovative drinking valve through which you can dispense the stuff into your mouth. Good way to go.
I also think there's a German brand, Ministry, they have gels. You can put it in the freezer and get a gel form ice slushy you can ingest, digest.
They are that clever. Interesting.
I think so. I'm pretty sure about this.
Interesting. Okay. Good. So when we talked about the solar radiation, you said like a black skin suit, yeah? Mm-hmm. What about clothing? I mean, like white, yeah. I mean, like this is more or less obvious. But I'm thinking about these headbands that, sorry to say, as a cyclist, totally look ridiculous. But is there a way, as an idea, just playing around, is to have like a structure or maybe some parts of the skin suit as a structure, like working as a having more surface to have like a better heat transfer?
So I was kind of chuckling to myself when you mentioned the white skin suit. The Olympics, I'm sure, stands out in everyone's minds for multiple reasons. It was a fantastic performance, but also Christian Blumenfeld wore a very white, very transparent triathlon suit. So it's excellent for heat transfer. Anything that either reflects or, well, not either. Anything that reflects the sunlight, the solar radiation away, is a good thing. Black is the worst color. A reflective surface, so like a mirror, for example, if you were a disco ball, that would be a very effective way to get rid of solar radiation. Might have some other issues logistically with that, but a white skin suit is a very intelligent choice. The transparency is debatable, but the white skin suit itself would be good.
At least the top part of it, where you're, if you're in a bike position, that's where your torso is horizontal and probably receives the majority of the solar radiation.
Exactly. Yeah. So Now, what you were saying with the additional cooling structures, so the Ohmius headband is a good example of this cooling structure that's essentially extended surface area for evaporation. So the idea is that it's the capillary forces pull the sweat into this this very high surface area structure, and then the evaporation cools it down. And then because it's a high conductivity material, it cools down your forehead where it's contacting. Mm-hmm. The thing that kind of pops into mind is whether you're looking at, a good example or something in my mind that sticks out, maybe not everyone can relate to it, but when you look at World War II fighter aircraft, for example, they often had radiators, like little shrouds for radiators that that were used to pull air in from just from the speed that they're traveling, and radiators used to reject heat from the engine. So if you had the same kind of system where you could funnel external air from the bike, you'd be giving up some aerodynamic efficiency, but you could funnel extra air, and if you're using that efficiently to cool your body, then that could be a way to actually improve the amount of heat transfer that you're getting. So maybe such a way doesn't exist currently, having a radiator for your body, but it's not to say that there might be some innovations out there that are just waiting to be discovered that could allow us to be much more efficient at removing heat.
But some of the wicking fabrics in sports clothing, like in your cycling skin suits, they do a very similar thing, right? So they are hollow, typically polyester fibers that, through capillary action, exactly as you described for the Ohmius headband, and they pull fluid, sweat in this case, away from your skin, and then allow it and give it maximal surface area. Sometimes when you see these ribbed fabrics, we're not talking about like aerodynamic ribs, but more for increasing the surface area for evaporative heat transfer. So some of the stuff already exists, and people have been doing this for quite some time, I think, in fabrics.
Well, definitely. I think you reach a point where there's saturation of the fabric, where the wicking effect doesn't matter because it's just wet. So you can't wick the fluid anywhere because the fluid is already everywhere. But we also had this discussion on our podcast a while back talking about short hair. So if you've got a buzz cut, for example, maybe more practical for men than women, but having a very short hair could pull the fluid or the sweat up to the, or basically hold it in place on your head. Mm-hmm. And you could have this, we called it optimal baldness, where we have a certain amount of hair loss or thin hair, but that actually improves heat transfer in your head. Now, maybe that exists. I don't know of any studies that have been done on this, but maybe that exists for arm hair, for example, or leg hair. So if you have, cyclists shaving their legs normally, that might be good aerodynamically, but it might be poor for heat transfer, where if you have a certain amount of hair, so if you allow it to, if you shave your legs and allow it to grow out slightly, there might be an optimal thickness that's better for heat transfer. So this is pure conjecture at this point. I don't know.
Sports scientists, if you're listening, we're giving you free ideas over here.
Many, many years ago, I had quite a interesting sensation with, I don't know what kind of cream it was. I was like in my 20s, so I had shaven my legs and I put this creamy stuff, and it was kind of oily. And I was riding, and the interesting thing was, like, as you described, the sweat stayed as like a thin layer on that oily part, and it was super cool. Yeah, it was my I was really shivering because I couldn't get rid of the sweat, so I really had to use my hand and just more or less whip it off. Yeah, and quite interesting, that it stayed so long on that area. So I'm not sure if it works really in heat, but in that case it was very annoying, and very cool.
And what's your opinions on the race suits or jerseys with those graphene in it to better have better cooling effects? I think BioRacer is something for the Tokyo Olympics, and also Ryzen is using it in their top of the range race suit, and they were, I think, developing it with Jan Frodeno, especially for Hawaii.
graphene is, it's one of these miracle materials that doesn't necessarily have a lot of practical uses. So my personal opinion is that the way it works well is spreading heat in a plane. So if you have a two-dimensional plane, it will do a fantastic job at spreading the heat there. Through plane, like normal to the surface, so basically if you're conducting heat from your skin out to the surface of your skin suit, it's not as good. It's still better than most materials, but it's not as good as it is in the single plane. So I think that the benefits might be lost there. It would be good at spreading the heat on the surface of your body, but I don't know that it's necessarily a miracle solution. I think there have been a few speed suits that they've tried this, but it hasn't really caught on. And I don't know if that's because of intellectual property, so if someone patented the idea, or if it's actually because it doesn't necessarily offer the benefit that they had provided or they had suggested that would. So it's neat to see these kind of materials come into testing, but I'm always a little bit cautious when it comes to, like, I would like to see hard data to show that it is a benefit.
Is Vittoria still building these graphene tires? Does anybody know? I mean, like, that was the thing, yeah? I mean, 5, 6, 8
Yeah, the Corsa Pros were marketed with graphene for a little while, but I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't remember if they still are.
Yeah. We didn't saw any difference, to be honest, in puncture resistance. So we tested it a bit. so much about magical things on materials. Heat measurement, and this is maybe something quite interesting now. Before I'm just talk about a little bit more about cooling, because this popped in my mind. Everyone is wearing core sensors today, and I think, or maybe for heat training, it can be a pretty useful tool. I think you had one of your guests was really testing that thing and did a quite nice study about that. So how accurate does it really work if you use it in the real world, and not only for heat training in your bathroom?
So I think one thing that's worth noting is that it is not a direct measurement, right? So whenever we think about, you know, this is a topic. This is one of my favorite topics of conversation, Bjorn, is like big picture is this technology intervention device useful? Mm-hmm. And the first question I ask is, does it do what it says it's doing? Right. Yeah. So, you know, the core temperature sensor, specifically core branded one, says it's measuring a core temperature, but it's not really doing that. What it's measuring is it's measuring skin temperature and mm-hmm. heat flux. Mm-hmm. And then it's using some kind of proprietary algorithm in order to calculate what your core temperature is, which is kind of cool, you know. And, you know, like if I was to compare it to, I'm getting off topic a little bit, but the running power meters, they do the same thing. On a bicycle, you can measure power. On running, you can't. So you have to measure something else and then, you know, do some interesting math. The core sensor, I've seen, you know, obviously Core themselves, they publish studies or white papers saying that, yes, this stuff really works. We validated against the, you know, a pill or rectal thermometer, sort of the gold standards, and we get good agreement between our data and their data. Mm-hmm. The study that you referred to that one of our guests did, and that was Antoine Desroches from University of Sherbrooke, I think, somewhere in Quebec. And he said that there was broad agreement, if I'm trying to remember now, broad agreement between changes in temperature. So if the athlete's temperature went up, then both the ingested pill and the core temperature sensor read a very similar change in temperature. Mm-hmm. But in terms of absolute temperatures, they did not necessarily agree. So that's to say that the absolute value of that you're seeing on your core readout may not be accurate, but if there is a delta in that value, if it's going up or down, then you're probably pretty safe in saying that it's reliable and accurate.
And if you're using it regularly and you understand that when it's reporting 39.5 degrees, I feel like this, then that consistency, I think, is more important. Similar to power meters, where having a consistent power meter is maybe more critical than having an accurate, absolute measurement.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if they also did that. Ingesting something cool, I mean, like, you will see that in, on a, in, when you swallow a pill or having a rectal thermometer. What about the core sensor? Do we see anything changing there? You know that?
I believe, I think I've only seen one piece of evidence on this. I believe the evidence that, the suggested evidence is that you would not see the effect on the core temperature sensor, which is bad for us as you know, if I may digress, as trying to market a product that keeps you cool on the bike. We initially thought we could use a core temperature sensor to prove that our thing worked, and it turns out that is unlikely to be the case.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So, is there any use for the core sensor? I mean, like, you said something, and the other thing is time scale wise. I'm not sure about the study. I've only read once. Does it have like the same time frame? Yeah, if you getting cool that it and you see that immediately when you have swallowed the pill. What about the core sensor? I mean, like, it's only measuring heat flux from the skin and outside. Yeah.
It's measuring skin temperature. So yes. I'm trying to remember what Antoine's study found, because there probably is going to be a little bit of a delay in terms of noticing the effect of cooling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talking about cooling, and this is why I just put that in, about your cooling bottle, which has another strategy of cooling. It's not like swallowing something. Maybe, Andrew, you explain it a little bit more in detail, because I think you run a study. How's it working?
Yeah, so what we theorized initially when we were developing this was that the forearms are an area where there's a large amount of blood flow. And the idea was that if you can cool down the blood going through your forearms, then that would return to your core and cool down your core. Or essentially, you're bringing heat out of your core. So with the cool bottle, what we were trying to do was use this internal energy and basically melt ice with it. So instead of using the environmental heat to melt ice, we were trying to use our core body temperature to melt ice. So the study that we did was done in a climate-controlled chamber, and there was we didn't use ice in this case. We used cooling plates that were strapped to the forearms, but chilled water was pumped through them. And we cycled for I believe it was a 45-minute time trial. So we did a control, and we did the cooled version of the study. And the ambient conditions were 30 degrees Celsius and about 70% humidity. Mm-hmm. And there were no fans or anything like that. So it was held at, I believe, 75% FTP. And it was a self-reported FTP for all the participants. So this study, there were varying effects that we found. But for myself, for example, I was, I believe, 7 beats per minute lower heart rate at the end of the study and half a degree Celsius lower core body temperature. And looking at the energy balance, so basically the amount of energy that was removed from the cooling plates, that roughly worked out to the amount of to the half degree Celsius lower temperature. So the energy was conserved, which is always an important thing to see in any scientific study. Mm-hmm. We don't want to violate the laws of thermodynamics, and it turns out we weren't doing that. But it was quite noticeable in my case specifically. I think I had one of the bigger reactions compared to some of the participants. But the seven beats per minute lower heart rate at a relatively low output, something that under normal conditions, if you're cycling outside, you would be able to maintain for quite a while. after 45 minutes in this heat chamber, my heart rate started off at, let's say, 120. By the end of the study, it was 175. So they were actually, for safety reasons on the control, they were within 1 or 2 minutes of pulling me off the test because it was approaching my maximum heart rate. So, and that was the control test. With the cooling, I was not as close. So that showed that there was some benefit to it. So we tried to take this same effect and replicate it with something that you could portably take with you, rather than having a big water chiller that you've got to carry around tow around when you're on the bike. So the cool bottle itself, it leverages this technology, and it in our study it was quite effective at improving the physiological condition of someone. Now what we've had more of a challenge with is saying, well, you're half a degree Celsius cooler, what does that translate to in terms of power output? And that's something that I don't believe has been extensively studied, or at least we haven't seen the studies for it.
That's why we went to you, Bjorn. That's how I connected with you. It's like, hey, I know you have a lot of this population data with your platform.
Yes.
And we're wondering if we can if you can help us connect some of those dots.
Yes, I already talked about that with Sebastian, and we already have an idea, because our algorithm or AI calculation and the work from the Smeet can replicate that. Actually, lowering heart rate means more power, so to say. So yeah, this is very interesting. Yeah, and only by using something cool on your forearms. Yeah, this is quite interesting to use. And I think you this is quite normal plastic, and then we have the water. A few days ago I was thinking about making that thing out of a very heavy, dense material to have like a cooler effect. But this, of course, would be super, super heavy. Yeah.
We tried that. We had aluminum.
Ah, you tried that. Okay.
Yeah. Our first version of this had aluminum pads that you would press against your forearms. And the consensus from everyone who tested it was way too cold. So it was just uncomfortable.
It was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Ah, interesting.
And it was basically, it wasn't giving frostbite, but it was to the point where you get like a freezer burn, or I don't know what the proper term is, but you get like a red spot, and it would be very uncomfortable to use. So we had to back it off a little bit. Okay. So we elected to just use plastic, and it's more like it's easier to sanitize. It's a lot cleaner material.
Yes.
But we had played around with that initially, and it was too much. But
limiters. Sorry, go ahead, Andrew.
Well, the one thing I wanted to briefly mention is this idea didn't come out of thin air. This was taken from nature. So as I mentioned before, biomimicry is a huge area of interest for me. And our motivation was actually watching some of the BBC programs with David Attenborough, where kangaroos were licking their forearms. They do that in the outback to help cool themselves when it's around 40 degrees. So the ambient temperature is at or near body temperature. And they were licking their forearms and using the evaporative cooling to cool their core temperatures, which was quite interesting. So we adapted that. So can't take full credit for the idea. Nature had quite a big hand in this too.
David Attenborough.
Yes, David Attenborough.
Yeah, one point I wanted to make about the stainless steel or the aluminum plates is that you hit a limit as in how quickly your blood that's under the skin and the forearms can carry away that coolness. Or the correct way to think about it is, how quickly can that blood add heat to the bottle? Mm-hmm. So if you have a very low resistance to thermal conductivity by means of like a metallic plate, then you just can't supply it quickly enough. And then what ends up happening, and this was, we were talking to trying to remember who this was that told us. It may have been Lindsay Hunt from Precision Fuel and Hydration. There's a certain point in the skin where the thermoreceptors in the skin will say, okay, well, this is actually really cold, and you actually get vasoconstriction, so you get less blood flow to that area because it's cold, and then you're blunting the effect that we want to have. We want maximal blood flow. So we don't know this for a fact, but we kind of conjecture that at a very high rate of heat transfer through those plates, you are actually reducing the effect that you want to have.
Yeah. I understand that. It's quite interesting because I talked about that with my little boys. We had these kind of thermometers where you just point a laser on it and see what kind of temperature it is. And so we had like a plate and a wooden table and stuff like that. So and ask them, okay, touch it, and is which one is cooler and which one is hotter and or warmer? And they just say, of course, the plate was cooler and stuff like that. So no, it's the same temperature. So the idea of conductivity was like more or less like mind-boggling for them. It's like, okay, this is the same temperature. They say it's a heat flux, so it's sucking out the heat. And so and I was I'm constantly thinking about that, just how can we, or is there some other ways to do we have some contact points on the bike to have this conductivity working? And the bottle is a very clever idea. I mean, like, hands is a problem. On your bottom is quite complicated with the saddle,
Yep.
and you don't want to have cool feet, It's limited.
Definitely. And of course, it only really works in the time trial or triathlon position, because it's the bottle, as you say, contacts your inner forearms, and it only really works when the bottle is set up between the aero extensions.
There is an alternative to this, and it's something that NASA has been using, because astronauts are actually a really interesting use case for heat transfer, for cooling, because there's no convective heat transfer to the external environment because there's a vacuum around you. So to cool astronauts, they have these capillaries, like capillary tubes that are stitched into their spacesuits, and they circulate a fluid around there to pull heat out of the body. So we previously had looked at removing the heat through these kind of means, but it's heavy, it's complicated, it's difficult to store a lot, or like basically remove heat effectively from the system as a whole when you're doing this kind of method. So there are ways to do it, but it's not as elegant as having something like the cool bottle. So there are other methods, and maybe someone smarter than us will come up with a nice way to do it. But it was an area that we had investigated, and it's something I'm still curious about. I would love to see someone come up with a solution like that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. We also talked about like camel bags, open camel bags with like heat transfer. I think there are also some skin suits now, Niklas told me. But I'm really looking for like more or less like this flexible bottle they put in. I think there need to be some more clever engineering in that thing to maybe getting a bigger area, or maybe having an isolated insulated upper part and not insulated that is on the skin and stuff like that. So quite interesting. I think the interesting also about your bottle is that you cool yourself with the forearms, and you can also drink.
So there's no extra mass you're carrying around, so it's an effective use of what you already have to take with you.
So the usual strategy, of course, for cooling is usually drinking. How much, sorry to jump around, how much of fluid can we lose to have like a performance decrease?
Oh, that's the $1 million question, right? There's a lot of debate right now.
Yes.
So you hear the 2% mass loss number, but there's I think it's not universally accepted as a value. So, but you know, that's the number that I think I've heard most often. So if you lose 2% of body mass, then you're probably going to start to see some performance degradation. But as I said, there are lots of examples where that is not the case.
And about drinking, how often, how much should I wait until I'm thirsty, or should I just continue every 10-15 minutes? What's your take on that?
Again, I would say that there's a pretty hot debate right now as to whether or not you should drink to thirst versus being proactive. I think it makes sense, especially for... So I think the best way to do this is to get a sense of what your sweat rate is for a given set of conditions. So if you know that you're going to be doing, an Ironman triathlon, and it's going to be fairly warm, then the best thing to do is to get a sense of how much you sweat under those conditions. Mm-hmm. And the easiest way to do that is the kind of the weigh yourself pre-activity, then measure, weigh everything that you consume during activity. Hopefully you don't have to pee. And then when you're done, you towel yourself off and you weigh yourself after activity. And so then you can say that I've lost X kilograms, and that is, and I drank Y kilograms, and then the difference would be the amount of water lost. And then you can divide by the number of hours you were out there, and then you can get a pretty reasonable sense of how much sweat lost. Lindsay Hunt, who I mentioned earlier, he created an online calculator to do that if you don't mm-hmm. want to go through the faff of it. Mm-hmm. And the beauty of that too is if you're going to be racing in conditions that you cannot readily train in. Perfect example was, again, Ironman Texas. If you're, it's January in Toronto and it's, -5 degrees outside, it's not practical to train in the conditions that you're going to see in Texas. So then you can use Lindsay's calculator to estimate how much you would lose. And so based on how much you think you're going to lose, you can start to come up with a rehydration strategy. Mm-hmm. There is an upper ceiling as to how much you can drink and absorb, which, again, can be trained. But generally, we hear that most folks can probably consume about a liter of fluid an hour, a liter of water an hour, and absorb it. Some folks can do maybe a little bit more, maybe a liter and a half. But that tends to be the upper limit. And there is some... I would say some conflicting evidence about whether or not adding sodium improves mm-hmm. your ability to mm-hmm. absorb sodium and carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. That was the classical thinking about it, but there's some new research saying that that might not be the case. Mm-hmm. So I think there is, I used to be, if you asked me this question 6 months ago, I would give you a much less it depends answer, Bjorn, but right now it seems like there's a lot of it depends going around. It's contagious.
How much can we sweat? So is there some number? Is it a liter? Is it two liters? Well, or is it highly?
Yeah, it's very individual. So I've seen numbers from like as little as half a liter. Obviously, it depends on conditions and mm-hmm. intensity, right? So the hotter it is, the harder you work. If you're, if you're riding at 400 watts versus if you're riding at 150 watts, it's going to be a very different scenario, because you're producing much less or much more thermal energy, as we discussed earlier. But I've heard numbers from as low as like 400 or 500 milliliters an hour mm-hmm. to as high as 2.5 liters an hour. Mm-hmm. And right, so it could be a factor of 4 or 5 sometimes. Mm-hmm.
From personal experience, so when I did this thermal test for the forearm cooling, they measured our sweat rate. And mm-hmm. I'm not an exceptional athlete by any means, and I was sweating 1.5 liters per hour. So, so to give an idea, like I'm probably on the upper end in terms of sweat rate. And if you can only replace a liter an hour, then that puts you in a deficit for longer events. It's certainly a difficult situation to be in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's also complicated if you consume high amounts of carbohydrates, as Cameron Worth did.
Yes, 200 grams an hour? 200 grams.
I mean, like, you need quite a high... how much liters did he drink? Do you know that, Niklas? I think you looked it up.
I think 1 to 1.5 was something around this. It was definitely the upper limit. And also, I think he got 1.5 grams of sodium, high on sodium
per liter. Yeah, that's on the higher end, but yeah, I think that's not unheard of. There's definitely recommendations for 1500 milligrams per liter mm-hmm. in terms of concentration of sodium. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Now that you mentioned nutrition, I think this is I kind of wanted to make this point is these performances that we're seeing that are, at least in triathlon, I mean cycling too, that are really like so much better than what we saw even 5 years ago. And Bjorn, I'm thinking of a conversation you and I had where you talked about some of the like the most elite cyclists, like Pogacar, for example. I'm paraphrasing what you told me, is the reason he can be as good as he is because he can eat a huge amount of carbohydrates as well on the bike. So his glycolytic capacity is no longer a limiter for him because he can feed that glycolytic engine. Hopefully I'm paraphrasing correctly. And that is interesting because our ability to tolerate nutrition, carbohydrates, is limited when we're hot because one of the first things that shuts down. So we're, you know, our body has blood as a resource, right? So it the most important thing for it to power is our brain. Otherwise we die. And then, you know, obviously the vital organs, because otherwise we die. And then after that, you have your muscles. So if your conscious brain is telling your legs to pedal circles because you want to go faster, the blood is diverted to the muscles, so it feeds the muscles to produce the mechanical power that we need to turn the pedals. When we get hot, some of that blood is diverted to the periphery, to the skin, which we talked about. So there's less blood to go to the organs. And I think it's one of the first things that shuts down is our digestion. Mm-hmm. So the whole, you know, the stomach and the GI tract require quite a bit of blood. That's why our resting metabolic rate is much higher than our basal metabolic rate, because food digestion takes energy. Even simple carbohydrates and gels and sport drinks, digesting that takes energy. And if we're very warm and we're working hard, the first thing that's going to quit is that digestive tract. And so if you're trying to get in, you know, 120, 40, 50, 200 grams of carbohydrate an hour, that requires a lot of work. And if you don't have if you're also very hot at the same time, that's a challenge. So I think that, and this is my kind of, you know, my theory, well, not just my theory, but I think it's borne out in the evidence that the folks who are doing really, really well right now is they figured out through training how to absorb all of that carbohydrate, all of that nutrition, even while they're hot. And I think that's the real trick.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I also had like this idea I was talking about, or left a message to you, and we also had a little chat about that. I give some of my riders now really, really high concentrations and carbohydrate intake, and doing very unpopular tempo training now.
Zone two.
Zone three.
Well, yeah, okay, two in the three zone model. Yeah, three and a five, yes.
Yes, and it's quite nice. I talked about that with the other World Tour coaches, and they discovered, oh, suddenly we have just maybe something, some kind of new training, yeah, that we can use. Because if you run a lab test or if you calculate that, you see, okay, we burn at this kind of power 150 mm-hmm. grams of carbohydrates. Why not ingesting that and riding in this kind of intensity and see what's going to happen? And we see a lot of very interesting things happen. Adaptation-wise, because we have a high energy flux in the muscles, which is always quite nice mm-hmm. for adaptation. And so I'm curious to see when Rönnestad runs the first study about that, or Zeiler. And so now this high carbohydrate intake opens up a lot of interesting ways to train, and for me it's quite interesting or exciting, to be honest, because I think in the next years we will see some new things about training popping up, and maybe we are now trendsetters about tempo training. Which That's makes cool. sense, because Niklas, I also talked about that with Niklas, and Niklas said, oh, I've looked at some races, you know, most of the times we're riding tempo. I said, yeah, really?
So there's a specificity why. Element, yeah. Before we would only, like in triathlon, we would stay the heck away from it until, you know, your specific block, your whatever, 8 weeks out or something, where you would do some of it so that you get accustomed to the intensity. Yeah, interesting stuff.
Good. Niklas.
I'm happy.
I'm just
thinking about this stuff, and I always think if we discuss more about heat and how to use things like core sensor, things like how you mix your drinks in the heat, how you cool down your body in the heat, I think that's one of the keys to get faster in every condition, because if you learn how you need to train your body for the temperature you're racing in, you will definitely always get better. If you train a lot of in the heat, your blood volume will go up and you will race better in the cold and also in the heat. So I think this whole new thing about heat training, and now also the thing with the high amounts of carbohydrate, and then okay, if you take those high amounts of carbohydrate, you also need the sodium, you also need the water, and all those things, I think in the next years the power will also always go up. It will be crazy, I think.
Yeah. To just maybe put it in a nutshell, so if we train or race in heat, the first thing is respect the weather conditions and the heat, especially if you go hard, if you're not used to or you have a sudden weather change, don't go too crazy, because your body needs to adapt, you lose power, and you maybe overheat, you don't want that. The next thing, if you know you race in 6 weeks in very hot conditions or in 8 weeks, start with an adaptation, and we will link, we put it in our show notes, one of your podcasts or maybe all of them, about the heat adaptation and everything, because I think they are great to listen to it. And the next thing is work a kind of a nutrition plan, hydration plan. How much do I lose? And sweat wise and stuff like that. And what kind of external things I can use to cool myself? Your bottle, for example, clothing wise and things like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think there's one thing that still I'm very curious about, and I have not heard any research, is how do. And I made this point on our last episode of our podcast, Bjorn, but the heat flux receptors, the thermal receptors, mm-hmm. are in our skin, right? Mm-hmm. So when we're out in the sun, and there's that incident solar radiation that's coming on us, yes, of course, it adds a little, it adds sometimes a non-trivial amount of heat flux, but the sensation of it is quite substantial. So yes. if you've ever, riding in the sun versus riding in the shade, and the air temperature is the same, the difference is tremendous, how you feel. And I'm trying to figure out if there's something there to mitigate that, just that perception of heat, of incident heat. Because that, for me, for example, is a serious performance limiter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we even had the discussion on on our show with rubbing a cold feeling muscle therapeutic rub on,
like a menthol rub or an alcohol rub. Yeah,
so something that would trick those thermal receptors. But I do know from our own experience recently, again in Texas, as we've mentioned many times, we were coming from very cold climates, and we stepped out into the sun, and when we were waiting for our rental car shuttle, both of us, I think, were sweating. And it was the same temperature as it was when we were in the shade, but just being in the sun made us feel that much hotter. And it's mm-hmm. amazing how much of a difference it makes. And this is, standing normally, so really this solar radiation was only incident on our heads, which some people have more reflective heads than others, I guess, but it wasn't that much heat we were taking in, but certainly the sensation was substantially different, and that's just I think those thermal receptors.
Mm-hmm. So maybe stimulating the hypothalamus maybe also work, mm-hmm. and the sensation of heat, so I think I've read something about that, or stimulating that and having a less cooler sensation. Or I only make it up. This maybe we see the people with these brain bands and try to stimulate their hypothalamus to have less cooler sensations. Yeah? So it will be quite interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think... I hope that people are still listening and it was not too nerdy.
That's our specialty.
Thanks for your time.
I think
we didn't mention control volumes once, I don't think.
Indirectly with the bucket, but...
So So it's more, yeah, to be honest, it was more or less a podcast for me, yeah, and not for our listeners. Yeah, I just had some questions.
Bjorn, that's why I podcast.
Yeah, I know.
I want to get smart people on the show to tell me stuff who would otherwise charge me money to for a consultation. So I'm like, yes. Nah, come do a podcast with me. It's a scam.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, guys.
We stay in contact. Do some calculations with heartbeats and power output and stuff like that. And
yeah, we'd love to see it.
Then, yeah, next time we talk about another topic. Thanks.
Look forward to it.
Have a nice evening.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.